morning, everybody. We have done 2 days on the important topic of assumption checking. And before we move on to talk about why HAT, there's just one thing I want to emphasize again that is written out for you at the bottom of page 22 in the reader. And this is the answer to the question, what exactly has to be normally distributed when we think about our regression models? And the answer to this question from the theoretical perspective is epsilon, the random variation part of the model. So remember, we have this model that says the observed y we get is equal to the sum of two terms, the mean for the population of y values where everybody has the same x's, plus a random part epsilon. And that's the part that has to be normal curve distributed. So in practical applications, what we need to do is take a look, as we did last class, at the residuals. And these need to be at least approximately normal curve for small or moderate sample sizes. So in particular, one of the things I've got for you on page 22 is you do not need the y's by themselves to look approximately normal. And you don't need the x's to be normal either. It's the residuals. And hardworking students, class after class, tell us the data are normal, and then they get back a paper from us that says, what exactly has to be normal? And the answer is the residuals or the epsilon. And take a look at that, because there are some older books that will talk about the x's and the y's being normal, but what you really need is the epsilons. And if you take a look at the page 16 plot with the little normal curves sitting over the regression line, that's a graphical way to understand that point. So when you're writing up your project and homework reports, be sure you tell us that we're absolutely requiring those random variability parts to be normal, and we don't need to make any assumptions about the y's by themselves or the x's by themselves. Now, one more topic that you're going to need to finish the complete story about the homework that we want to spend a little time on is the use of y hat. And I think what's particularly challenging about this is the fitted values really can answer two different questions. The fitted values can tell us our estimate of this mean E of Y given X. That's the first use they have. And they can also help us predict, with a little bit of quotes around that, a thinking in context, a future outcome value, given that we know the x's. So, for instance, in our running example with the birth weight and the estriol, one of the things I said is we might be in a situation where we could measure the mother's estriol level early in her pregnancy and try to predict the birth weight for the infant with the goal of seeing if she has a low estriol level, is she so low that she's at risk of a low birth weight infant? And both questions, what is the mean birth weight for all mothers who have an estriol level of 15, or what would we say about a future outcome value for just one mother with an estriol of 15, our estimate or prediction is the same thing. It's Y hat from the regression. It can help us answer these two questions. And these questions are related, but the important message from today's class is that the standard errors used in confidence intervals around Y hat are different for these two questions. So this is something that when you're working in discussion today and you look at the homework questions, there's a strong a signal as I can send you. We want to estimate the mean for all women with a certain number of months of experience and put a confidence interval around it. And then there's another question that says we want to estimate with a one number point estimate and a confidence interval for one individual woman with a certain length of experience to kind of sort these questions out. And for those of you who took Public Health 142, Professor Sullivan's book only deals with the first question. So this second question, how we get a standard error to predict for an individual, isn't something that you've seen before. And we're not going to emphasize the formulas on this because STATA can help us get them, although I do have some discussion of that in the reader. Basically, what we're going to do is try to figure out which question we want to answer and then take a look at how we're going to make our confidence interval. Both questions use a t-distribution. And the degrees of freedom in general are the number of observations n minus p plus 1, where the p is the number of x's. So in the one you're doing in the homework and in the estriol example, we just have one x. But that's the common formula for the degrees of freedom that we're going to be using. And both assume all the assumption checks are okay before we use the t-distribution. Again, we have only 31 observations in the estriol example. You have 60 in the homework. So using the t-distribution requires that our residuals satisfy the normal curve assumption, at least approximately. So how we're going to do this in STATA is we're going to use the predict command to get our calculations for the standard errors. And something you have to be careful about is which options do what. The comma STDP gives us the SEs for the situation where we want to know the mean of a population. So I sort of think of that as standing for P for population. And the other one says STDF. And this is how we get standard errors for predicting Y for an individual. So we had you in the lab do those calculations, and now we're going to talk about how we put them into confidence intervals. And we can generate these values pretty easily. if you go to the estriol example with me, if you take a look at page 47, I've got some of the calculations there that we can take a look at. And again, I try to put things in my variable names that help me figure out what the heck I'm doing. Stata doesn't care that I said predict SEBW population. It paid attention to the comma STBP. And in the next one where I said I wanted to get the standard errors for the individual, it paid attention to that common STDF. And I realized in the homework I said things like standard error wage pop and standard error wage individual, and they look like sewage, so you can have a little fun with the names. But the important thing is you need to know which option, STDP or STDF, is going to do the calculations for you. And the advantage of this little data set is that we only have 31 observations, so I can list out for you on page 47 a number of the values, and we can take a look at them. And one of the reasons I did this is to show you concretely that the value of X is involved in how the standard errors go. And the user fact that you have to remember is that points far from X bar have larger values for these standard errors when we go to make the calculation. So for instance, if you look at the first observation listed on page 47, where the value for the estriol X is 7, the fitted value for the birth weight fit that we've looked at is about 25.78 in the hundreds of grams. And if you take a look at the two standard errors, if I want to do the estimate the mean birth weight for a population of mothers who have estriol equal to 7, what the Stata calculations for the standard errors tell me is that the standard error to use to answer this question in the units of the problem is about 1.65. That's in the SEBW pop column. And if I want to predict the birth weight for one mother whose hormone value is equal to 7, again, I'm going to use 25.78 for my point estimate, but if I'm predicting for an individual mother, Stata tells me that I have to use a much larger number, 4.16, to make that calculation. And if you want to ask yourself, why is this SE so much bigger? The practical person's answer to the question about why it's 4.16 instead of 1.65 is that the individual Y values vary quite a lot around the fit. We've taken a look at some graphs with this example, and the points aren't that close to the line. So you have to be very careful to figure out which question it is that you're trying to answer. And the other contrast I want to make is what happens if we have a value that instead of being kind of low for the estriol at 7, we're more in the middle. So estriol equal to 7 is near the lower end of the x values. And in contrast to that, I'm going to also take a look at an estriol of 17. And that's pretty close to the x bar. And we'll pick up and take a look at those numbers as well. So if we look at mothers with an estriol equal to 17, we actually happen to have some 17s in the data set. For instance, this is the observation number 11 values. If you take a look at estriol of 17, which is close to the X bar, the fitted value in this case, you can read it right out of the output in the 11th row, the fitted value is about 31.86. And the two standard errors, the standard error for the mean birth weight, again, just reading out of the appropriate columns in the output, this is what you're going to need to do for the homework. The standard error for the mean birth weight in this case is about 0.687. And the standard error for a particular mother where we're just looking at one infant birth weight, if you take a look at that row, it's 3.88. So again, it's much easier to try to say something with 95% confidence for the mean birth weight for all the infants. But if you take a look at these numbers, the reason the ones for estriol equals 7 are quite a bit bigger than the ones for estriol equals 17 is that in the one case, I'm fairly extreme on the X, and in the other case, I'm close to the X bar. Okay, so without sort of making you memorize the formulas, we want to take a look at this. And you'll see this also in the two questions for the homework, whether I'm extreme on the X closer to the middle makes a difference in the standard error. So you need to be able to find these things in the data output. And then once you've figured out which question you have and which standard error you need, putting things together to get a confidence interval follows the fairly standard pattern, point estimate plus or minus a t multiple times whatever is the appropriate standard error for your question. Okay, so it's the same degrees of freedom for the t as you're using for a confidence interval for the slope. It's the degrees of freedom that go with the sum of squared residuals. And so I've done several of these on page 48. And because I don't like to carry around a calculator, I tend to use the Stata display command to do my calculations. You can get Stata to print out a lot of things that can be quite helpful. So the first thing I did at the top of page 48 is I used Stata to be my t-table. And so I asked Stata to take a t with 29 degrees of freedom, because that's the 31 minus 2 that goes with this problem. And Stata told me that the landmark number from the t-table to go with this picture with 2.5% in the upper tail is about 2.045. And yes, Stata prints these things to a ridiculous number of significant digits, but we're going to use 2.045 for our calculations. So this is the number we need to put into the pattern to figure out what we're going to get if we want to get 95% confidence intervals to go around these fitted values. And the other thing I'm sort of illustrating here that I've had you do a little bit in the homework is you can put comments in your Stata output. You just start the line with a star, and then it just kind of prints. So there's my getting the multiple that's going to help me make my confidence interval. And then I've tried to put here parallel phrasings to what you're going to need in the homework. So if we want to make a confidence interval for the mean infant birth weight for the population of mothers with estriol equal to 7, if we say we might have lots of mothers with an estriol of 7, our 95% confidence interval for the mean birth weight starts with my point estimate, 25.78, plus or minus 2.045 from the t-table, and then the standard error that goes with this question is 1.65. So I had Stata do the calculations for me with the display command, and if you have the review window open in your Stata over on the upper left, you can click on the command and just change the plus sign to a minus. You don't even have to retype all the numbers. But if you take a look at what Stata got for us for this calculation and turn them into grams, we've got 2240 grams for the lower limit and 2915 grams for the upper limit, which is quite a range of birth weights. In particular, the point estimate is a little bigger than the international standard of 2,500 grams for a low birth weight baby. The point estimate is 25.78 grams. But when you make the confidence interval, the lower limit is way below 2,500 grams. And the other point to take a look at this is the confidence interval is almost 700 grams wide. And then you want to say to yourself, okay, we had a significant slope. We know there's an association between estriol and the baby's birth weight. But from this one hormone, we can't predict very closely. It's much harder to get a precise confidence interval than it is to say we've detected an association. So for a clinical perspective, this interval is really wide. If we do the next question, and instead of a 95% confidence interval for the mean birth weight, we looked at the other standard error, and we said, okay, I would like to make a prediction for one mother. I get her reading of 7. I would like to say, what does my analysis tell me about the birth weight for her baby? And the answer is going to be very disappointing. Because if you take a look at the third calculation I have there, which I've labeled prediction interval for the infant birth weight for an individual mother with an estriol of 7, again, we start with the 25.78, but now we have to have 25.78 plus or minus our T number, 2.045, but now that is multiplied by the standard error of 4.16. And so when you make that calculation and turn it into grams, you get a confidence interval that goes from 1727 grams to about 3429 grams, if I round that, 34.2872. And so that's kind of useless, okay? You probably don't need a statistical analysis to tell you that the infant birth weight might be between 1,700 grams and 3,400 grams. It's extremely wide. Again, why? We only have 31 observations. We only have one X, and the points aren't very close to the line. So this is a rather extreme value of estriol. It's kind of near the lower limit. Let's see if we do much better if we take our estriol near the average of 17. And so I've got two more calculations there for you to take a look at. And the pattern is going to be the same. But now if we want to do the mean birth weight, it's going to be 31.86 plus or minus 2.045. times the standard error, that's 0.687. And the other calculation for the individual, again, our best estimate is 31.86. But for the individual to allow for the points to be quite far from the line, the standard error is going to change. And if you write out what those two intervals are, basically I have here 30.46 grams to 33.26 grams. And again, for the individual, the last calculation on page 48 is 23.93 grams to 39.79 grams. And again, it's very difficult to get good, tight confidence intervals for an individual. Okay? When you see this interval, again, it's very wide, you know, 1,600 grams. So we know there's an association. We didn't have a very tight confidence interval for the slope. And when we ask if we're ready to predict birth weights based on just the hormone level, the answer here is clearly no. When you're doing your projects, if you have a model that you hope to do for prediction, what I'm going to want you to do as part of your project report is sort of write a little summary like we've done here. I picked a fairly low estriol level. I picked an estriol near the average. To sort of do an A-plus project report, you would also want to pick one fairly near the top limit. Just another sort of interpretation comment. If you take a look at this example and you take a look at the summary statistics, we had observed estriol values from 7 to 27 in our data set. So I would be cautious about trying to extrapolate this relationship to values far outside that range. You could probably extrapolate a little bit beyond the upper or lower endpoint. But if someone said to me, well, you know, physiologically I could get an estriol of 36, I would be really reluctant to use this same equation because I'd be assuming that the functional form could extend up to 36 beyond 27. And I would have to really worry physiologically whether or not I could do that. So there's a question in the homework on one of those that says, what extra assumption are you making? And there's a hint that says, look at the range of the X's. I think in one of the homework questions, we've asked you to go about a year farther out than the maximum of your data. And what I'm asking you to think about is, can we extrapolate for 1 year? And the answer is, that may not be too risky. Could we extrapolate out for 5 or 10 years? Probably not. If you take a look at the graphs in your homework, there aren't very many women in the right-hand side of the graph. Almost all the points are concentrated in the first half. So practically speaking, when you use these formulas, you need to look at your range of X's and to ask yourself if you're in a situation where you can go a little bit beyond the X's you observed, but not way far. So if you wanted to use these data in our experiment, you want to pay attention to that their little study got values between 7 and 27. This is important. It's not emphasized so much. It depends what the purpose of your regression is. When we talk a little bit more about regression modeling, we'll come back to this. But if they hope to be able to say, let's get the hormone reading and we can flag people as being at risk, the width of these confidence intervals should tell you that you're not ready to do that. Okay? We're going to shift topics a little bit. We don't always have a nice 50-minute for a single topic kind of thing. Much to everybody's relief, I think, we're going to skip over the solving the least squares and the equations, but something important I want to introduce today and set you up for the lab for next week is working with multiplicative relationships and exponential growth. So page 66 is where we're going to jump to, and at first we're going to look at a couple of rather deterministic examples of multiplicative growth. And then we'll follow that by looking at some data that reflect multiplicative growth. What we have been doing in regression is when we make a model that says the mean of y is equal to beta 0 plus beta 1x, we are doing an inherently additive growth kind of model. And what I mean by that is as we move from x to x plus 1, e of y changes by adding beta 1, basically, is what happens. And what we're going to start to look at today is multiplicative or exponential growth, which is probably as common, if not more common, than additive growth. And we're going to be able to extend our regression model to deal with this kinds of growth. So I took these from Warren McCabe, which is a pretty good introductory textbook. And so the first thing we want to talk about is a little example that has to deal basically with the practical consumer application of compound interest. So Maria gets a savings bond from her godparents or her family at birth, and her family members in year zero invest $500. And this is from a kinder, gentler time. So she gets interest at 7.5% each year. You're not going to find these now, okay? But it makes a nice example. So her parents hang on to this bond until she's ready to go to college. What's it worth? Well, basically what happens in the compounding, even if it's just compounded once a year, is by the time she gets to year 18, this is now worth more than three times. 1837.90. So this means everybody should save for college, okay? But that's deterministic. The bank is committed to paying that so long as they hold the bond. Another application of multiplicative growth is often in situations where you're trying to look at bacteria. E. coli grows fantastically. If they've got ideal conditions and they've got enough food, E. coli double every 15 minutes, which is partly why there's such a public health problem. Okay? Eventually it gets to the point where they're out of resources, but they got lots of room to expand. So if we took one bacterium and it grew under ideal conditions, what would it be facing in 24 hours? Basically, it's going to get 95 times to split. One goes to two, two goes to four. The answer is that starting from one E. coli in 24 hours, this data has to go into scientific notation. It's 3.96 times 10 to the 28th. Got to go into scientific notation to print the numbers. So this, again, is deterministic. Every 15 minutes, they all divide, and you are left with, I'm not even sure I know the name for the number when you have that many zeros after the decimal point. And finally, one more kind of fun one is the clever courtier who knows more math than the king, and offered a reward by a king, the clever courtier asks that they bring out a chessboard with its 64 squares. And it sounds trivial. One grain of rice on the first square, two grains of rice on the second square, and then again we have a doubling up until 64. And then to do a little bit of calculation, I didn't even sum from 1 to 64 the terms, how much rice goes on the 64th square. When we have all this doubling on the very last 64th square, we get 9.2 times 10 to the 18th grains of rice. That's just kind of there to impress you that multiplicative growth can be amazing. Okay, both the E. coli and the good stuff doubling grains of rice. And of course, you'd have to remember some stuff from calculus about summing series to figure out how much rice total, but it would be a lot of rice. So this is just a little warm-up introduction to multiplicative or exponential growth. And then I have a couple of examples that use real data. Again, I borrowed these from Warren McCabe, and I'm plotting them in Stata as well as introducing the regression. Basically, the technical tool that we're going to need for dealing with multiplicative growth is we're going to analyze the logarithm of the y in the regression. And if it's been a while since you've had to deal with logarithms and exponents, there's a link on our class vSpace to the School of Public Health, University of Minnesota math refresher, and they will take you through some material on exponents and logarithms. You can go right to those pages. But this is something that's going to be in the lab for next week, because what I'm hoping to illustrate with the next couple of examples is that this is really common. And I'm so sad in the U.S. that everybody doesn't come out of high school with a really good understanding of logarithms, because logarithms are all over science, biological science, physics, and they get used a lot in statistics. Okay? So here's the first example on page 67 from Warren McCabe, and this has to do with the U.S. population growth. And they've got numbers as best they can from the census every 10 years. Remember, the census is in the Constitution. I don't know if they read that part. They left out a lot of the good parts when they read the Constitution. They left out women getting to vote. I don't know why. So I don't know if they read the thing that the government is mandated to do its best to count the population every 10 years. But the first census was in 1790. So here's a plot of the values from 1790 to 1990. I'm hoping that you will look at this visual and say, oh, that's curving. The population isn't growing by adding a constant number of people every 10 years, but we're going to see that there is a fairly strong multiplicative relation. So what I've done at the top of page 68 is illustrate the data generate command, and statisticians like natural logs to the base e. We use those a lot more than we do base 10. So I've asked at the top of page 68 for Stata to generate a new variable that I called lnpop. And again, Stata doesn't pay any attention to your names. It pays attention that we said log, open paren, and then the variable name while I had the population. And something that's really good to know, looking ahead soon to doing your projects, we're trying to illustrate a little bit for you how to label variables. So the next command, label variable, lnpop is the variable name, and then I just put in quotes, it's the natural log of the U.S. population in millions. And I took a look at a regression using that logarithm as the y and the year as the x. And then, as we've been doing in lab, I got my fitted values. I didn't really get the residuals here, because what I want to do is show you what the graph looks like on the log scale. And the log transformation isn't perfect. The points don't seem to randomly vary around the line. And one of the things that's interesting, if you look at this graph on the log scale, the population growth has actually slowed down from 1950 to 1990. How do I know that? Because at the upper end of the distribution, the points are actually all below the projected line, and the population growth in the middle is a little higher than the log model would fit. So although Moore and McCabe use this as an example of something that shows multiplicative growth, it's not completely perfect because the points aren't randomly scattered around the line. Yeah. So here's the thing. It is not completely a straight line on the log scale either. You're correct. There's a curve on page 68. So that's why I'm saying that a model that says we had constant multiplicative growth doesn't completely describe this phenomenon. Okay, the points are above the line in the middle, and then for about the last four points, they aren't growing as fast. So it is not a perfect transformation. The reason I did this is because I'm doing my best to try to make this log stuff accessible. But the U.S. population grew faster from immigration in the late 1880s, early 1900s, and then it actually has slowed down if you take a look at what's going on post-1950. So it's not as mechanistic as the grains of rice kind of growth. Okay? So I did a couple of absolutely mechanistic examples, and what I'm trying to do now is introduce you a little bit to what we do statistically with logarithms in some really simple situations where I can make plots. And you're going to see in the next two plots that, you know, this isn't bacteria, so the phenomena we're going to try to model don't exactly fit the log. The lab you're going to get next week, the GSIs and I, several years ago, actually constructed the data so that it is pretty darn close to a logarithmic model. But I'm trying to give you some sort of real life examples where people might at least think about multiplicative growth and to see that these models don't work exactly perfectly either. And the other thing, it's really hard if you didn't have a good high school education, and now, you know, for the MPH students who are over 30, you have to go back and learn logarithms, okay? You got to rag on your school boards and rag on your kids and nieces and nephews to learn that log stuff, because you probably never thought you were going to need that much to help solve the world's problems, but you do. Yeah. There's a curve.
Right.
There's a curve. I'm going to try taking the natural log if I see a curve, and I'm going to ask empirically if it works or not.
Okay.
And what I want to tell you is in the examples we're talking about now, it doesn't work perfectly. We're going to give you a lab where it does, but I had to artificially generate the data.
But if I was working with real world data, I might get
natural log is closer, but not perfect. Correct. And in particular, then you go talk to your friends in the demography department, and they say, oh, yeah, yeah, we grew a whole lot in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and then we changed the system and passed very restrictive immigration laws in the 1920s, and then we've been trying to convince people that they should have quality families and not magnitude families, okay? So if you want to do this for population analysis for developing countries or for developed countries, you're going to see that lots of people will try the log model and it won't always work. And again, we're going to give you a homework where it does. so that you can see why people think about this. We're going to take a look next on page 69 at world oil production. And there's going to be some bumps in those graphs too. Okay, and again, I took this from Moore and McCabe. I'm not sure how we know what the world oil production in millions of barrels were for all these years. And notice that in this one, unlike the census, the years aren't equally spaced. So they have an observation for 1880, 1890, 1900, 1905, 1910, but they don't have to be evenly spaced, okay? So what does the graph look like? I've also used a Stata sort of techie, geeky thing to fit a curve. I've asked it to use a spline curve, a piecewise polynomial instead of a line. But if you take a look at just the sort of fit by connect the dots at the top of page 70, let's see what we get. Okay? It looks very wonderful for the hydrocarbon industry until we get a couple of bumps in world oil production. And people are talking about now that we may be maxing out. Okay? But if you take a look at this, the first thing is, as Robin says, is this looks like a curve. And then there's some very interesting wobbles near the end that the system may be getting a little bit unstable. But again, what I did is try the log. If you take a look at the plot on page 71, where I've taken the natural log, it looks pretty good, except for the last couple of points, where again, the points are below the fitted line. And what happens in these models, and what we need to do a little math refresher for, is if we have a log to the base e of y fit as a linear regression, and both of these, the x is actually the years, then what the marvels of mathematics tell us is that if we exponentiate both sides, which is the inverse transformation of the logarithm, what we're going to get is when we exponentiate the log, we get approximately y, and it's about e to the power beta 0 hat times e to the power beta 1 hat x. And then if we take this equation and we look at x and x plus 1, then what is going to happen with this equation is we're going to look at a ratio of the y's. And the GSIs will do this with you again in the lab next week for a second time. But if you take a look at the ratio of the y's, for x plus 1, the math tells us we would have e to the beta 0 hat, e to the beta 1 hat times x plus 1. And if you do some math on this, you're going to get the second term rearranged into e to beta 1 times x, and then you're going to have e to the beta 1 times 1. So basically what's going to happen is if we make a ratio for the value for y with x and the value for y x plus 1, e to the beta 1 hat is a multiplicative factor. The way we get y for x plus 1 is we take y for x times e to the beta 1 hat. And again, the GSIs will do this with you again next week. And so finally, what happens in this example, if I exponentiate my coefficient on the oil example, if I exponentiate my coefficient, I get something like about 1.065. And so what I have there in the interpretation is the percent change is about 6.5% per year. Okay? And you want to be really careful about extrapolating this one. It's not so much a statistical question as a subject matter question. We're not going to be able to keep taking more and more oil out of the earth without limits. Okay? So this is an extremely important model, and we'll give you a homework so you can practice on this. There's one more example coming in the lab next week, but the whole point of this last part is that multiplicative growth, at least approximately, is something that we need to be able to handle.